Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. This is an off-the-shelf edition of The Book Show in partnership with Northshire Bookstore in Manchester Center, Vermont, and recorded before a live audience. Jodi Picco is the author of a string of best-selling novels with themes often mirroring the headlines. Her latest book is The Storyteller. The novel is about Sage Singer, a young woman from a Jewish background who becomes friends with Joseph, an older German man in town. Soon, Joseph asks Sage to help him die, a fate he says he deserves because he was a Nazi officer. In the process of finding out more about him, Sage learns more about her grandmother's own story of surviving the Holocaust. Again, the new book is The Storyteller. It is a great pleasure to welcome Jodi Picco to this week's book show. This book is remarkable because, and I tried to summarize it just a bit in the introduction, but at what point do you come to that idea and say this, not only that idea, but say, this is something I can work with and think about and have my readers think about?
This book in particular began with a different book. It began with Simon Wiesenthal's book, The Sunflower. I had read it probably in high school at some point, and I was thinking about it and thinking about the general conceit of the book. It was written about an experience he had as a concentration camp prisoner when he was called to the bedside of a dying Nazi officer, and this guy wanted a Jew, any Jew would do, to confess his sins to so that he could then be absolved and die in peace. And over the course of the book, Wiesenthal comes to see that he cannot forgive this man. Even if he wanted to, he is not the one upon whom the sins were perpetrated. Those people are dead, so basically the Nazi is out of luck. Since the book has been written, it has been republished in multiple forms with new epilogues at the end, commentaries by theologians and politicians and philosophers weighing in on what Wiesenthal came to decide to do and telling what they would do in their situation if they had been in that situation. And it kind of got me thinking, if you do something really, really bad, could you spend the rest of your life trying to do good things and ever erase that stain? And by the same token, if you consider yourself a morally good person, is there any one thing that could make you do something the rest of us would consider pretty bad, like killing someone? And was there a way to take what Wiesenthal had written about and update it for a modern generation in a way that would allow us to see why these stories are still so important 70 years later?
The nature of good and evil. That's what
really
you
it.
Want us to think about.
Yeah, it was a tiny little thing I was thinking about, but yeah, that was it.
It's simple, and yet I assume takes you a long time to get to that point of saying, this is how we are going to portray good, this is how we're going to portray evil, and oh, by the way, you may not be able to tell the difference.
For me, it really did start with good and evil. You know, what does it mean to be good? What does it mean to be evil? And I still remember walking and thinking, well, what's the worst thing anyone could do? And immediately I thought, the Holocaust. And that was immediately where I went.
With that in mind, and saying, okay, that's where I'm going to head. What you are known for, of course, is the research.
Right.
Of going into the research.
Yeah.
So stop one for you is where?
My mother. Yes. An unlikely place, but my mother lives part-time in Scottsdale, Arizona. And I knew she had been to some Anti-Defamation League events. So I said, you know, do you think that you could arrange maybe to find some Holocaust survivors who would talk to me? And I swear to you, within 30 minutes, she had a list of 9 names and contact information, and she really ought to work for the government. She's a little scary. And I actually wound up working my way through that list and talking to many of the men and women on the list. I can tell you about some of their incredible stories. There was a man named Bernie. Bernie grew up in a town of 5,000 Jews. By the end of the war, there were only 36. He told me how, when the Germans came to occupy the town, his family and friends would go into the basement of their apartment building, and they would hear the Germans walking around upstairs while they hid. One night, there was a young woman who was carrying a baby that was crying. The baby wouldn't shut up, so they kept feeding it little bits of bread, and it was still crying, so she juggled it up against her shoulder, and she accidentally smothered her own infant. She walked upstairs, sat on the curb, and just stayed there for 3 days until the next roundup, because she had nothing left to live for anymore. Bernie also, when he was finally taken from his home, he managed to grab onto the doorframe of his house and pry off the mezuzah, which is a little strip of metal with a scroll inside that's been blessed. He held onto that mezuzah in the bottom three fingers of his hand, curled around it for the entire war. His hand fused shut, and after the war, he had to have it surgically opened so that the mezuzah could be taken out. And he showed it to me when we met. It was absolutely incredible.
Wow.
And he's just one survivor. I can keep going.
Well... Okay, so how do you not become intimidated in the sense of, well, how as a writer, how as a storyteller, am I going to beat that?
Well, I don't think I can beat that, nor would I want to. There's no way fiction should ever take the place of reality, particularly in the case of these stories. These men and women have very important stories to tell. The character of Minka in the story, who is Sage's grandmother, the one who is the Holocaust survivor, is braided together from threads of many people's lives. Everything that Minka experiences has happened to a survivor that I spoke with. And so I basically created a new reality for her by shaping all of these incidents together into one whole. I don't really see it as creating something bigger or tougher or sadder. I see it as blending a lot of realities.
When you blend those realities, tell us how Sage came into the mix, because this is a young woman mm-hmm. who is dealing with the death of her mother, mm-hmm. and she's having a really tough time with it. She's going to a grief group. This is where she meets Joseph, who's 95 years old.
Right.
And she's been through a lot. Mm-hmm. She's been through a lot of these groups, and it's tough.
Sage is a loner. Sage doesn't connect because of a scar on her face and because she has this horrible secret she's hiding, and she's just not really good with people. And it is a surprise to her when her new best friend is a 95-year-old man, of all people. And not just that, but a 95-year-old man that everyone in town knows. You know, he's everyone's favorite adoptive grandpa. He is a retired teacher. He leads the 4th of July parade. She's like the only person in town who doesn't know him. When he asks her to help him die... Because he used to be a Nazi, he doesn't realize at first that her grandmother is a survivor. And so, you know, it adds this new wrinkle. If she decides to help him, is it mercy? Is it revenge? Is it justice? Sage was a really important character to me because she epitomizes a lot of the young generations in this country today who are thinking, why are we still hunting Nazi war criminals? They're in their 90s. Who are they going to hurt? And why do we have to keep talking about this stuff? It happened so long ago. Sage also is of Jewish heritage, but not a believer. She is an atheist, a confirmed atheist. And that was another very early decision that I made, because I think there is a tendency to think of the Holocaust as a Jewish issue. 6 million Jews died in the Holocaust. Well, 5 million non-Jews died in the Holocaust. It's not a Jewish problem. It is a human rights problem, and everyone should care about it. So to be able to get Sage to a point where she is convinced this is still important, this is still necessary 70 years later, is to convince anyone who's reading it.
Obviously, with your Jewish heritage, do you look at it and say, okay, this is my view of the issue?
Well, no, because like Sage, I don't identify with a religion. We're all humanists in my house. I grew up with parents who were, I would call, marginally Jewish. We did not have a religious existence, but, you know, yeah, we did have a Seder every now and then, and we never had a Christmas tree. My religious upbringing as a child was very much based on culture more than it was religious doctrine. And at this point, my family doesn't subscribe to any religious doctrine. And for me, it really does not come down to God. Almost like in Minka's case, Minka comes out of the Holocaust and is not a believer anymore. You know, and that is what I found talking to survivors. Half of them became very religious and the other half really didn't want anything to do with religion anymore. So I really could have gone either way with her. You know, I feel that it's very important to not marginalize the Holocaust just based on religion, because that's kind of what made us get there in the first place.
In reading this novel, it reminded me of two of your past books, and one is Keeping Faith, which you delve into the issues of religion. Does that help in the writing or even in the research that you sort of have that baseline?
Sometimes it does. It didn't in this book because it wasn't as though I retread ground with previous people who'd helped me do research. But for example, the rabbi that I used to do research in Keeping Faith wound up helping me again with other books in the future after Keeping Faith. So that was a good connection to make. I do think that too is a book about the nature of belief. So is Change of Heart, for that matter.
And that was the other book I was going to mention, because that's very much about forgiveness.
Right, exactly. I think I could write 40 books about belief and forgiveness and maybe come down on a different side of it with every book, because what I'm thinking at that point in my life also changes.
With that, you and I are just about the same age. We're in our mid-40s, and you've written a lot of books in that period.
What have you
of
been
time.
Doing? No, I'm kidding.
Well,
sorry.
Exactly.
I'm kidding.
I mean, that's a lot. To sustain that and to keep it and ultimately to find your niche, to find your place in that huge market.
My first book was published when I was 25. I'm 46. I've published a book a year. There were times we were off by a month, which is why it's not 21 or whatever. I've been working really hard and really steadily for a very long time. It's interesting that you talk about a niche because I was a very hard sell when I was starting out. I don't think the publishing companies really knew what to do with me. I did not write books about women who meet in a hot tub and discover they're all dating the same guy, you know? And I think they would have preferred if I was writing that, actually. But I wasn't. I was writing about things that were really heavy, that weren't light, fluffy beach reads, that were emotional and devastating, and that often asked a morality question. And it's to write morality fiction, if you want to call it, you know, a niche, is not new. You could certainly say that Dickens did that, for example, or Jane Austen did that. But there weren't many people doing it when I started out in the 90s. And I think the niche sort of grew around me because I didn't want to change what I wrote. So instead, I just was lucky enough to find people who actually wanted to read it. And then told their friends and so on. And, you know, we got to a point where more people were reading my books and maybe publishers began to think, oh, we can publish this stuff.
Neonaticide, the death penalty, mercy killing, stem cell research, what it means to believe in God, what it means to not believe in God, the right to die, gay rights, the Holocaust.
I'm a party, aren't I?
So, with those issues, morality fiction, what do you want us, the reader, to do? Because you have said, look, I'm not coming to any conclusion, but it's something that you want the audience, you want your readers to wrestle with, because you're wrestling with it.
Right. I don't think it's my job to tell you what to think. I have an opinion. I'm very outspoken. I'm always happy to tell you my opinion. But my opinion is no more valid than your opinion. And your opinion may be different from mine. What I do think it's my job to do is to take a given controversial situation and lay out all different facets of that issue so that you then get to look at it and decide why your opinion is what it is. You may wind up changing your mind, you may not, but it is probably the first time that you've ever really evaluated why you believe what you believe. Most of us form our opinions at our parents' knees or because our church told us to think that. Sometimes it's good to shake it up a little.
The thing I find interesting about your work and about those issues and the issues that you write about, of whether it be the death penalty or gay rights or stem cell research, is that we as a reading public are buying into that. We're thinking about it. We want to read about it. It's not the women in the hot tub. It's deep.
Yeah.
And it's heavy stuff. Why can't we then take it one step further after we've put down the book and do something about the issues?
I don't know. If I had the answer to that, I'd be a lot more wealthy than I am, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, you're doing all right.
No, I honestly don't know. I don't know where the transition goes. I think, you know, I don't know. Maybe we need to ship copies of my books to everyone in Washington. Maybe that's the answer.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, I think that, I do think that we often become polarized in our country. One of the reasons I've written books like, for example, Change of Heart was because I really felt as though you could almost fold the country on a fault line of religion. And I really wanted to look at an issue that is very divided by religious beliefs, which is why I picked the death penalty. I think that the first step is being able to have empathy for someone who doesn't think the way you do.
The fact that your books are so popular, the fact that people are reading them, the fact that we have a theater filled with people here tonight indicates that those issues are resonating and people want to talk about them. And I'm sure I was just watching you in line. People want to talk about this stuff. And it fascinates me of then when the book closes, perhaps we then stop thinking about it or talking about it.
I don't believe they do. I really don't, because I think that's what fiction does. Fiction allows you to then take the book and say to someone else, read this so we can talk about it. And having those conversations, I think that's really the way you begin to change the world. I can tell you that I've had letters from kids, for example, who were disowned by their family after coming out and then read Sing You Home and said, I read that book and you made me feel normal again. That's an amazing thing. I've had letters from young men and women who said, I was suicidal. I read The Pact. I don't want to wind up like Emily. I'm telling an adult today. You don't expect to change a life when you write fiction, but every now and then you do, which is a remarkable benefit and a really humbling experience. I think that it's a slow change, but it's a sea change.
Mm. And by no means do I mean to put all of this on your shoulders.
No, I know, really. I'm going to have to leave now.
Okay,
I have to
now
change
it's
the world.
Your job. Right. But us as a society, because we care about these things. It seems like that we innately care about them.
But I also think that there's a tendency to think of Americans as pretty stupid, you know, and readers as really stupid. And I don't buy into that. I have never dumbed down my readers. I don't want to write chapters that you can finish in one toilet sitting. I don't want, you know, I'm not gonna not pick a topic because I think that you don't understand.
That puts
understand
a picture
it
on the radio, doesn't it?
Right? Yeah. It's... Yeah. You know, I really trust my readers. They are smart, engaged, intelligent people who have always been willing to go wherever I want to take them, no matter how crazy it is. I'm really thrilled by that, and I'm really grateful for that. A lot of writers don't have that gift. They don't have readers who are willing to engage and who are willing to go wherever you want to go. Some readers want the same book over and over. I think that's exactly what my readers don't want.
Just looking at the book, it seems to be the way they're marketed is toward women. But you have said many times that just under half of your readers are men.
Yeah, I was so tired of being called a women's fiction author that I actually kept count for 3 months, and 47% of my fan mail comes from men. More women usually come to events. I think it's because they have to get out more, you know? But I get a lot of letters from guys who read the books and take away very different things. They see themselves in the male characters. A lot of my books have male protagonists. And, you know, there's no reason that you can't read a book about the death penalty and identify with it as a male. I don't know why anyone would think that's a particularly female-centric topic. I think, honestly, we live in a country where if you are a woman and you have 2X chromosomes, you must be writing chick lit. I don't think that's necessarily true. There's nothing wrong with chick lit. It's a great genre. It's fun if you want something light and funny to boost you up. And it's got a place in the literary canon as much as mystery or thriller or morality fiction does. But anyone who reads The Storyteller and says, this is a great work of chick lit, I don't know what they're thinking.
And yet, you have the light tones, and there's the back of a woman's head. And do you ever have that fight with the publisher and say, you know, do we have to do that?
This was actually the second incarnation of this cover, and believe me, this is the better one. You know, there's only one cover that I flat out said, we cannot do this. It was for Handle With Care, which was about wrongful birth lawsuits. And the picture was this very close-up fetal profile. It was like a baby in utero. And it totally creeped me out, honestly. And I left it on my kitchen counter for a few days just to kind of see what would happen. Everyone who walked into my kitchen went, oh, what is that? So I said, look, this is not going to work. It's very off-putting. And, you know, they said, oh, but it's a baby. Everyone loves babies. I said, that's not a baby. That's like a half-cooked tadpole, you know? And anyway, I mean, I trust publishers to know what sells in their market. This book would never sell in England. My British covers are so quiet. The colors are much less brassy. That doesn't sell in America. In Poland, all my covers are cartoons. I don't know why. You know, so it's a very interesting thing, but publishers tend to think they know their market. In America, there is a tendency, like I said, to assume female author must be pitched for women, must look like a woman's book. I don't necessarily think that's right, but the alternative is going to be, you know, the Harlan Coben thriller type the storyteller, you know, in big block print, and that wouldn't be right either. I don't know necessarily what the answer is. I'm just really grateful to men who look past, you know, the pretty girl with the flower in her hair and say, I don't care, I just want to read the book.
Right.
But again, keep in mind, over 60% of the book-buying public is female in America.
You became my patron saint when you were very outspoken to the New York Times about their review, their multiple reviews of Jonathan Franzen, and said, look, you got three reviews of a white male.
Yep.
And there's a lot of great books being written by women, and you're not reviewing them.
Right. And I tweeted that, and honestly, I didn't expect it to be the ginormous storm that it became. I think it was just a very slow news day. But, you know, I basically...
But good for you.
Yeah, well, you know what? One of the really nice things about being a successful writer is that people do sometimes listen when you speak. The interesting thing about that is when I said that, immediately the backlash was, oh, stop whining. What are you complaining about? You're successful. You know, you have readers, you have fans, you have sales. Why are you complaining? I actually wasn't complaining. I get plenty of reviews. I get a lot of review coverage, actually, for a commercial fiction author and for a woman. But there are a lot of women who don't. And if you're lucky enough to have a moment at the podium, isn't it a good thing to stick up for other people who haven't quite gotten there yet? And that's really what I was trying to do and what I continue to try to do. You know, if you're at all interested in this, Vita is a group that actually crunched the numbers to see the disparity between the number of reviews given to male authors versus female authors, and also the number of male reviewers versus female reviewers. And across the boards, and especially at the New York Times, it's roughly sometimes two-thirds to one-third in favor of men. So I'm not making this stuff up. It's true.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I mean, I really don't know, because like I said, the majority of book buyers are women.
Are women.
So we've got a lot of female readers. At this point in publishing, there are still a lot of women in publishing, even in the heads of publishing companies. But I think, unfortunately, at some of these older review outlets, whether you're talking about the Times or the Atlantic, they are still a very patriarchal guard.
What kind of coverage have they given you? I saw a piece that they did in February with you that was, it was a Q&A.
Yeah.
And...
you could call it that. It could be an attack, too. I don't know. Yeah.
It's very much what it seems like.
Yeah. That was a three-hour interview.
Really?
That was cut down to one tiny page, yeah. And they get to make the cuts. It was a very interesting experience. And I actually think I came off as, you know, I spoke my mind. I told the truth. Nothing he said was inaccurate. You know, I was blunt. You know, again, I think there's that sense, well, you know, she's just whining again. She's complaining again. That really wasn't what I was trying to do at all. But I wasn't going to lie to him either. So, you know, and I get a lot of coverage, actually more coverage from the New York Times than a lot of commercial fiction writers who are women. Most of the time, they don't review the book and they just complain because I write commercial fiction. And that's a whole different problem, because in addition to the disparity between men and women writers, there's also a huge disparity between the attention given to commercial fiction writers and literary fiction writers. There is an assumption that because Mr. Franzen writes literary fiction, his work has got to be more worthy and better written. But there are lots of commercial fiction writers who are very wonderful stylists and craftsmen and who push the envelope when they try to write commercial fiction. And I think to dismiss them out of hand is absolutely wrong.
So when you think about the next step, you're going to a new publisher, and actually in that New York Times piece, one of the things that you said was, I'm not necessarily looking for sales, but you did say you're looking to be more of a franchise.
The best way I can describe it is this. You have a room full of readers here.
Right.
And most people, if you said my name to a room full of readers, they would say, yeah, I know who she is. But if you said my name to someone who admits I never read, they will not know who I am. Yet, if you said the name James Patterson to them, if you said the name Joyce Carol Oates to them, they're going to know who that is. And I think that right now in America, there is sort of a branding of names. I've been very lucky to have sales and to have readership. But I think for me, to continue to evolve, that's what I would really like to move into.
Jodi Picoult's new book is The Storyteller. It is published by Atria. Jodi, thank you so much for being with us. What an absolute thrill.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Special thanks to Katie Britton. This off-the-shelf edition was recorded in Manchester Center, Vermont at a Northshire Bookstore event, northshire.com. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.